All right, welcome everybody, and a special welcome to Julian, our hostess with the mostest. He has not been on for quite a while, and he is the original and still the host of the show. So everybody, make some noise for him, and this should be a fun episode.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Hey, you started this. It's been sad not having you on. Enjoy our conversations. I had some topics for today. We could start with those, or we could go into anything personally that's happening in our lives or anything, or just kind of take it wherever. Okay, topics I had. So one of my favorite casts is the Logan Bartlett podcast. I don't know if you guys actually listen to it. So he's a growth investor at Redpoint.
I've met
him. And he started off pretty slow, and now they're obviously using it for deal flow, which is actually super smart. The content and the guests that they're getting are just like really amazing. And they started out, well, they didn't start out slow. They had Aaron Levy on initially and stuff, but then they kind of went through this like weird phase of like not getting the great host, and even Logan would be like, oh, it's you go through this like trough of like you can't get really good hosts on, but that now they have some really killer hosts. So I have two things to bring up from some of his recent episodes, and I'm just going to copy what his content is, but I thought that it'd be interesting for us to talk about it. So the one thing he had the Webflow founder on, which anybody that doesn't know, Webflow is probably living under a rock. They've raised $120 million in venture capital. We use them for our marketing website. They're kind of a beast. And one of the things that really stood out is that they started so this is probably going to make us not have the Webflow founder on this podcast, but we're here for other founders. They actually make their investors sign a social contract with them before they will allow them to invest, to be like, we will do, and you can imagine, I don't know what exactly is in there, but
yeah,
I really wonder like how much does that turn VCs off? Like, they're now upheld, which kind of goes to my second point, my second topic. But like to hold a VC to like a social contract, to be like, they're going to do no harm. They're going to also, I think there's like an eco part in that as well. Like it's a really weird thing, but also they've obviously gotten, I think they did this really early on. I kind of thought this was like a really kind of stupid move given like how hard it is to raise money, but maybe that kind of speaks to how good Webflow is as a business to attract this, but like it's just like not normal. And also I kind of think like this kind of goes back to like the Brian Armstrong, like we should be here for, from Coinbase, like we should be here for building the best product ever, like we're not here for political reasons and all that, which like I actually believe that to like a bone. Like I don't think that you should be bringing in social causes into your business, which probably goes against Mark Benioff's like give 1% of your profits back. I think that like we're out there to build products for customers. And when you kind of get intertwined into the social economics, whatever, it just creates a fucking lot of mess. And it's just like, you're going to turn a lot of people off. Maybe you're going to turn some people off. Is that the right thing you want to do? Sure. But I think you should do that with your own money. Like once you're Zuck or whatever, Mark Benioff, like go get hospitals, do all that great stuff. But like keep it straight. Like VCs need to return money to their LPs. Like founders want to obviously make as big of a business as they can to eventually have some sort of liquidation event so they can support their families. And let's be real here. Like if you're a venture founder, you're looking to get rich, like let's not like sugarcoat it at all. What are your guys'
thoughts? The one place where Andy smiled a little bit at the rich part. So we know that's true on his behalf. What's the question?
What do you think of the social contract to a VC?
Yeah, they go.
I think Webflow is a special company. I think I believe the story was they raised a small round. They spent a bunch of years iterating. They may have been close to profitable or profitable, and so had a different way of being able to do it. I think for somebody who's, if you have your choice of the litter, if you've built a real business, you can demand different things than if you're constantly burning, if you're in a lesser market, if you're in something that people just aren't as interested in. That's a long-winded answer saying, yes, sometimes you can demand different things from different people. I don't know if they'll sign up for it. The social contract point, I think it just goes and different people want to build different type of companies. Mark Benioff believes that his company has a mission. Coinbase believes that his company is there to facilitate money transfer on the internet or something along those lines. We can debate the pros and cons of this all day long. I think the case study was Etsy, and when they announced a B Corp, and don't quote me on this, but I'm pretty sure that Etsy, once they had a new CEO and converted from a B Corp to a C Corp, the stock ended up going up like 10 times. And they did some very different decisions. So again, I think you can have a business that has a social mission and purpose. I think you have to design that business for yourself. And I think you can find an investor base who believes in that.
Andy, I have a question for you. Do you feel that, or rather, it always felt to me as if what happens in these contracts like venture, I mean, I've signed a number of venture contracts throughout my years doing this, but you've probably been involved in more. And isn't there just, feels to me like there's just a way that this would happen is that it would be an extremely vague clause that really wouldn't mean anything.
I think this is probably something that's a side letter that's not in the documents, that's probably written like a management rights letter. I've never seen one of these. I don't know. I mean, we have to get the founders of Webflow to tell us more about their social contract.
So my thought, you're right. It's probably a side letter. Okay. That makes sense. Hey, that's a better coffee than you were drinking before. So you're right that it's probably a side letter. It feels to me like companies that are flyers. I had Andreessen use this phrase to me. Someone at Andreessen used this phrase to me at some point. And I've been using it ever since, this idea of flyer companies. Companies that are blasting, companies that are so obviously successful. There are two types of ways that a venture deal can go. There's a third way, but the third way is like straight up punitive. So like if there's this like super punitive transaction where it's like where the investors are barely there and they're not even likely to actually do it, and there's a chance that they back out, and then it's going to be a down round, or it's going to be a recap or some other thing like that. That's a third type of deal that could go on. But let's ignore that for the moment. Let's imagine that it's a deal that people want to be in. There's two types of ways that a venture capitalist will go. One is the VC will do anything you fucking want. That's one of the ways that it will go. And then the second way that it will go is that it'll be just that strong back and forth negotiation. And there's no way that anything like that will enter. So those are the majority of deals. The majority of deals are companies that are kind of doing well, but are not just like blasting off the way that maybe Zapier was blasting off when Sequoia invested. And then when they are doing that, they can insert those random things in contracts. So have I been in that type of transaction before? I definitely have. I definitely have been in that type of transaction where I had that type of leverage. But I think it's rare, and it's a 0% interest rate phenomenon, probably, is the way that it feels to me.
Probably, but also to other founders, like, would you recommend doing something like this? Like, it just seems like, it just kind of seems like there, like we've talked about before on the show, there's a few things that like, you just don't fucking mess with. Like you are like platform. You got to get the right finance platform. There's just certain things that like, you don't need to innovate on. And this just seems like something that is just for one, I wouldn't even say like if you're not going to get the right investors or whatever, like maybe you are going to turn down some investors, which is fine if this is, but I think that it's just a boondoggle. It's like, how much time did it take you to get this like written? Like, how much more time could you have spent on your actual company building it? Like, it just seems like I
hear you, Kevin. And of course, from a sort of straight capitalist standpoint, that's true. But what are the magic things of entrepreneurship? Okay. You know, from my standpoint, and like, lots of businesses are created every year in America, in Canada, in the world. Okay. And in these places.
In Canada? They're created in Canada?
Yeah, I know. Shocking, but true. Most of them off IRAP credits. Motam joke. And so what happens is entrepreneurship is so fragmented and multifaceted that it will take 100 million firms. And that's actually like the magic of entrepreneurship. And it's why some companies are special, is because someone did it differently than everyone else expected
to do it. That's true.
And the result of that is, oh my God, this blast off company. You know? And so
you think of like WordPress, for example, right?
Right. Like, yeah. Breather was one of those companies. Everybody was like, what the fuck is this? But like those companies have magic moments and magic ability to take off because they did something differently. And so I'm for it, even though every fucking many iterations of that are probably stupid. Whether the Webflow one is stupid, it clearly is not, because it's resulted in very good investors investing nonetheless. Right. But like, here we go. Yeah. I'm going to get unfriended. I love capitalism for this. I think it's a representation of the various ways that humans want to build things. And I think that's an amazing thing, even if many manifestations of that in the real world are fucking dumb.
But our audience are first-time founders. Should they waste their time on this shit?
Look, it's your company. It's your decision. Like,
they have the leverage.
That's the beauty of it. You're building a company because you're tired of working at your job. You're tired of doing things the way they were done before. Should you add a social contract? If you want to. I align with Julian. I'm more of a capitalist. And at the end of the day, there's a stakeholder theory of management. There's a pure capitalism theory of management. But did the Webflow, were the Webflow people in a flyer position? Yes. Did they have leverage? Yes. Did they want to do this for their company? Sure. We'll see if it works out. That's their prerogative, not mine.
Yeah.
You're exactly.
You just watch, you know, you watch the, you know, it's like an evolutionary theory of how companies get created. You watch the Galapagos Islands version of a company. Lutke talks about Shopify. He talks about it like Ottawa was the Galapagos Islands, right? And he's right. And that's the reason that Shopify ended up manifesting the way that it did, is because they were from the middle of nowhere. And that results in special things. And so like, it's entrepreneurship, it takes a super bullheaded, crazy person to start a company and to go at it for like 4 years while it's still only vaguely right. You're actually the most bullheaded person on this show. Right now. Yep. And so it takes a super bullheaded person to do it. And I love that. And actually, I'll go even further. I have a higher acceptance of entrepreneurs being fucking weirdos, because they have gone to bat for their weirdness versus just being like weird, like on the internet, on Twitter, right? Like behind being a so-called keyboard warrior or something. Instead, they're out there being weird in the real world. And I fucking love it. Should people listen to this show do it? I mean, no, unless they really care about something. And
they have something that is like Webflow that is very unique, or all of the, I think the thing that rubs me the wrong way is that there's just this standard advice that's given. And it's usually from companies that have like this insane business model or insane product market fit. And it's like, oh, this is what we've done. But like the reality is like, we all three of us are like just scraping to find product market fit. And I would like heavily argue against anything that doesn't go towards that. Like, it is a waste of your fucking time. And that's where I'm like very, this is not like negotiable for me. Like, it was probably like, I don't know when Webflow decided to actually do this, but like, it definitely took away time that they could have been building even more features for me, who I'm a customer, which I love them.
It did. Like, I mean, like, this like could have been this. Something that so, they wrote up thing, for 15, 20 question. Minutes or 30 minutes. I mean, it maybe took an hour. And so, like, I think we're out.
They have to get every investor to go through it, and then they're going to have to bring it to their partners
to approve the side letter. Like, this is a major decision. Took any time whatsoever. And I'm sure it's something that, like, you're talking about it as a real contract, but it's probably like a pledge, to be totally honest with you.
I think it's
Google
also,
do no evil. Does Google do sure. evil? Sure.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody is like, oh, yeah, do no evil. Oh, yeah, sure. And everyone has signed the side letter. I want to be respectful to VCs who are typically smart and are well-meaning people, but like, nobody is signing a side letter, I shall never do any evil, and it is in any way legally binding, that means something.
Right. That's fair. I was just thinking about like the time that it would take to get this done and then explain it to like, we're different. We're not like every other startup, and like, you have to take this eco pledge and all this stuff. It just sounds like a lot of like, just not focus in on the actual, like, the goal to get
there,
a product
just,
market
just
fit.
To be and then just so they got second. There and got product market fit and funded it off of revenue. So it's not really what they were doing.
That's awesome. So, yeah, maybe I'm completely wrong. And also, I love Julian's, like, every company is different and, like, they have different needs and wants and all that. And that's, like, the beauty of entrepreneurship. The second thing, which is related, which let's spend, like, 5 minutes on, is, like, do you think, I think this came up in that same episode, but also I've seen a lot of companies focus on this. Creating values like in the seed stage or even Series A, as far as like, this is like, is that something that people should focus on? Do they even know what their values are before your culture is formed? Is this a waste of time? Like, I know people that like, they'll spend like weeks and weeks like trying to develop like their values and put them on the wall and all this. It's like, meanwhile, nothing's getting fucking built and all this stuff. What are your guys' thoughts on that?
Well, wait, hold on a second. What did you do at Ship?
It didn't have any values until we were
Series B. Very early on. I'm not going to sit there and say I spent weeks on it overbuilding, but how are you going to hire people if they don't fit your values? How do you motivate them if they don't fit your values? How do you instill the way they're supposed to act? I mean, every day, so at Val, I mean, we would do values every 2 months at our all hands for the reason that everyone remembers them. Everyone understands what they are. And I think it's incredibly important as you start to hire people and go above five people in the room, that if your values default to transparency, you hire people who are transparent and or know how to be transparent. So I'm not saying this is some like, this shouldn't be this month-long exercise, but I have a general sense of how I want to run my company and what type of values I want to instill in people. So I'll take the exact opposite on this one.
Julian, what do you got?
Is it a hiring advantage? I think it is, right? Andy, okay. Kevin thinks no. That's interesting. So I think it is a hiring advantage.
I think it is for certain types of people. I think that there's other people like there are certain things that I do in the hiring process to even test like especially when you're seed or Series A, that to see how like nimble you can be and like lack of documentation or like lack of onboarding. Like, the onboarding in the seed company is going to be shit. Series A is going to be shit. I think if you like over index and all that stuff, like, you're just going to attract the wrong types of people. I think also values kind of comes into there, where it's like, these are all of our values, where like, you're obviously, intrinsic, like, inside what they are. like for me, it would be like very entrepreneurial for like seed or series A, extremely mm-hmm. curious. So like look for things like if you're interviewing an engineer, like look for side projects. Like what is their GitHub repo look like? Look for just mm-hmm. like, do they know like the latest version of whatever technology that is you're going to be using? Like there's a lot of ways that you do that, but I think putting values in front of them, actually, I think more. It attracts the wrong type of people that That's actually need. This is why we have this podcast here, that I think that like I intentionally don't do that. And I intentionally don't have the best onboarding process. Like once you do hit product market fit and you're hiring like more or less like cogs in the machine that are like, look, they're expected to do, like, you know exactly what they're going to be doing. And also to be clear, like there's super smart people and they're going to be like solving really hard problems and everything. But this is like more or less like you figured out what you're building, what your audience is, what your go-to-market is, all that stuff. I think from going from 0 to 1 is just completely different from going 1 to like whatever millions. And I think all of the advice out there, especially, well, except for Peter Thiel's 0 to 1 book, is all around like, you look at Stripe and you're like, oh, this is how we interview people and all this and like Facebook and all this. And I think that's just different for smaller stage startups.
I don't think you can really listen to outlier companies.
I also have interviewing people. You can sit there and give the interview to maybe your co-founder or somebody else on the team and they can sit there and check the box. Are they entrepreneurial? I mean, if you don't establish that value that you want people to be entrepreneurial, how do you know that the third person you hire is also going to hire entrepreneurial people? I mean, that's why you set this stuff. You're building your pyramid. You're trying to build leverage. I mean,
that's the reason you want a good onboarding experience.
Yeah. The reason I actually spend time on this is because the better the onboarding experience mm-hmm. is, the more efficient people are going to be in less time. So I would like my team members to be efficient on week 2 or week 3, not on 90 days. And so that's why I spend time on my...
Kevin? What was the size of the business at Chip? The most employees at the time?
300.
300. Okay. I mean, you could no longer interview people yourself.
Of course not. Right?
And so like it reaches a stage where it's, what is it, Charlie Munger or something that says, make your business like so simple an idiot could run it because one day an idiot will.
Yeah, no, that's totally true.
So it's like values are a way of doing this. My hot take is this. It is very difficult to make the values honest. I'm actually just coming up with this on the fly. So hopefully no one like hits me up about it like later. But I think that it's hard for values to be truly honest. For example, and we'll say transparency as a value. And when someone says transparency, it's like, but really though, to what degree are we transparent? Is it the business is going bankrupt and you're telling everybody? Is that the level of transparency? And so like there are some values that I will just say are not dishonest, but that are naive and perhaps optimistic. And I think that like in startups, it's like, well, we work really fucking hard, so fucking hard that it actually is going to break your back. Like, that's a value.
Yeah.
And most people will not say that. But it actually is true, and that is the type of person that someone wants.
Yeah.
And Uber was a fascinating, this is my hot take, is Uber's a fascinating example of someone who was fucking relentless. And he was like, he's like, you better be a killer or a get out. Lots of people disliked him for that. And there were reasons that he was taken off. And then we can go into that some other episode. But like Travis was very clear about the company that he wanted to build. And it was like ruthless, assassin, killers all the way up and down. And it actually was manifested in the values. And then when the CEO came in, the new CEO, what's his name? DK Derek Khosrowshahi. He replaced them. because he was like, I can't let this be a company of killers anymore. But at least it was honest. And it really did present, here's the type of business that we want to be. And it had a really strong opinion. You know, you pointed to the Peter Thiel example. One of the things that he does, it's not him, I think, but is like startup values need to exclude people. Otherwise, yeah. they're not real values. They can't just be like, we're friendly. We're friendly part two. We're friendly part three. Has yeah, the values.
They have
those
to
aren't
be
real.
Distinct. And typically they're not distinct at all. It's just like, it's all the same bullshit. And like, I would rather have people that kind of need to figure things out on their own. And then obviously, like, you're the, whoever's hiring the people, like, you have the values that you want, right? Like, it's not like I'm just saying, don't like put them on the wall and like, this is what we're going to be doing and all this. And I would actually be curious to like, to hear Travis back in like the day, like when they were like 11 people, like, was he like, we're going to be killer assassins? Or was that actually, did that come from like, cities are like not wanting us to be there. We have this like massive competitor lift that we have to kill. Now we also have to kill all of these other like global car sharing apps, all this. Like, I'd be really interesting to see where that came from. My only point, and let's move on, is, and I get the last word because Julian has not been hosting for a while, is that you should focus everything you can on product market fit. To Andy's point, if it doesn't take a long time and it's beneficial, I think that you should do it. And that sounds great. But if it's going to take like 20 hours of your time or a week or something like that, get back to building product, talking to customers, developing your go-to-market motion, all that stuff. This is what you have to do when you're going from zero to one. So
yeah, PMF is all that matters before
all
it
that
happens.
Matters.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you have the best team. Doesn't matter if you have.
Doesn't matter.
No. You could recruit the best of the best. And if you didn't find that product market fit, your company is going to die. So next thing, and I also took this from the Logan show. Which was a very interesting, and I would actually love to have her on the podcast. Her name is Liz Zoloman. So she wrote a book. So she's a two-time entrepreneur, raised over $100 million in venture capital. And she wrote a book with Jerry Newman, who is, and the book is called Founder versus Investor. And
actually was going to have Jerry on the show, but he is not an investor, but he's not a founder, but he is one of my investors. In the...
Oh, he's an investor. Okay, great. So you obviously know about the book and everything. That
yeah.
I thought that the discussion that they had, and we could bring up a bunch of different topics here. And like, as you know, like the title Founder versus Investor, there are so many different like misaligned incentives. Especially as you get later on. So they talk through that in this interview with Logan, but they also have written a book. How do you, let's start this off. So, and also I like Liz a lot because she's like a no bullshit person. She's like I'm not here to like, I'm looking to run a company and I'm looking for feedback. Like, I don't want feedback in the boardroom that it's like, you guys are not doing well. It's like, well, help me the fuck out. Like, what should we be doing better? Like, yeah. can you refer me to some coaches or some other executives or something like that? Like, and it kind of came down to like, what is a board for?
Yeah. The original,
what do you guys think a board is for?
Yeah. The original thing, this came from the book, began as a result of Jerry's blog, which is called the Reaction Wheel. And his blog has a post which went crazy, which is said, board is probably going to fire you. And that post did the rounds and it turned into the book. And it's actually, that post is right. And
it is right.
The direction, the
over 50% of founders get fired.
by their board, the only people that fired them.
Yep.
And so Jerry deliberately took this and said, we're going to make it adversarial because actually it is adversarial. And that's ideally, venture is a friendly area so long as everyone's making money or has a chance of making money. And when that turns sour, then it absolutely is adversarial. So it's like what is the job of the board? I will say I have an unusual situation that today Andreessen Horowitz is exceptionally helpful, but not a lot of venture firms can do that. Like for example, we have a lot of Teams customers today at Practice where we serve like teams of solopreneurs for the first time, and big transactions are coming out of this. And so like now there's just a guy at Andreessen Horowitz and he's like, hey, I'll help you like change your product marketing in the direction you need to do it. And he'll just get on the phone with you and hundreds of other entrepreneurs to do it. Now that's the job of the investor, but not the job of the board. I would say at Breather, one amazing thing that the board helped with, I was a good fundraiser, but they were also good fundraiser, right? And so they really helped the business get financed. And that is game changing. But in a lot of cases, they're really like their primary thing is to just protect their investment. And there are some board members that are zero value for sure.
Well, and that's what Vinod Khosla's whole thing is, like most board members actually provide negative value to the company succeeding, which I definitely do agree with him. And the best that you could hope for is somebody that's going to be just like net neutral, like help out when you can, don't cause a lot of ruckus. I've definitely seen in boardrooms, like it's like an ego contest and you have like this big firm and they want to like kind of show off to the other big firm and like take like this board meeting, which I do think that boards should be around governance. I do think that it also is a good forcing function to actually go through the plan and the metrics. And like, if you didn't have that, if you didn't have
accountability,
you didn't have that accountability to really smart people that you took money from, I think that it would be, you'd probably put your head in the sand and like that. I think that's a good, even early on, I do think that you should have, even especially if you're a first time entrepreneur, your seed rounds, I think you should take on a firm that actually wants to have board meetings, because and they're very like, you shouldn't spend a ton of time or effort or whatever, but it's like, here are the metrics, here's things we're building. Like, and it's a time to kind of reflect from the CEO to really like pull back. But I think that where they're, and they go through so many like interesting examples as far as like early investors are probably the most aligned with the founders, right? Like, they are the ones that they are going to make the most amount of money, potentially if there's a sale, not most amount of money, but their multiple off of their investment. And then the latest stage investors are the most misaligned to what the actual founder or even the business potentially could actually have. And I think that a lot of people don't realize that. And I want to get Andy's take because
I was much younger when I was on the other side of things. So I don't know that my advice from that perspective would be very helpful.
I don't know if you know about this book at all.
What's the goal of the CEO? What's your take? What is the goal of the CEO to come? And this comes from Amp It Up, to come in to present your plan, to receive advice from their board. I think there's another type of board, a prescriptive board, where they try to tell the CEO what to do. And I don't think many experienced VCs and many experienced investors try that unless the company is materially off the rails. I think the reality is first-time CEOs come in and don't know what to expect, and so they end up getting told what to do instead of coming in with a plan and asking for advice. I mean, that's what the role of a board is to do, to provide advice and guidance. In a venture-backed startup, yes.
Do you, Question, do you actually think that the role of a board is to give advice to the CEO and management team?
It's probably not advice. The word is perspective.
It may be advice. If they can, but
I'm using the wrong word.
Yes.
It may be advice. It may be thoughts. It may be color. Whatever your... It's what do they think about this plan?
Yes.
Then it's the job of the CEO to sit there and say, is that, quote-unquote, advice correct?
Yeah, it's perspective. And then it's like, you want people around the table, definitely. Here, there are so many mistakes because you insisted on having the last word, Kevin. There's so many hot takes that you missed from me. But here is one that on the board side is, I think
what
people should have perspective about what their board members say. And a first-time CEO will often be naive around what a board member thinks and the wisdom, quote-unquote wisdom, so-called wisdom that they provide. So for example, someone on the board could say, need to grow faster. And you need to grow faster could come with a additional burn. But really, that person has, you know, a different investor who sit on different boards. That person could be sitting on 30 boards in a early stage business, right? If they just sit on a board every single time in an early stage business.
Right.
And so they're not spending the time. They don't really get what they themselves are saying. Yeah, we need to grow faster. Wait, I didn't say increase burn. Yeah, you did, actually. You didn't. You just don't know that you said it. And now what I did, because I'm an idiot that's a first-time CEO, is I listened to you. And so that what first-time entrepreneurs often miss is they have a board member and they think that their board member is all-knowing. And I myself have been that naive for sure. And you get these people and you're just like, well, they're an investor. They've seen like 100 businesses. They must know. It's really, really not true.
They don't.
At best, your investor is world-class at best in one thing, one dimension. And if that's true, fucking great situation. But at worst, as you said, they're providing negative value, at least in a couple of dimensions. They may not be universally negative, but they might provide directional feedback that is straight wrong. And they just don't know it because they are not full-time in your business the way that you are. That said, the perspective is always helpful, but it's... You know, the tough part is when you need that next round, you need part of that next round. Okay.
Yeah.
So you just raised 10 million bucks. So now you want to raise another 10 or 50, 20, whatever. And now a part of that money is going to come from existing investors. And when you disagree with them, they start to feel like you're not good and it compromises the capital that you need for your next round. So now it's like, fuck, well, what do I do? I'm going to mouth off to my investor. Yeah. And so, you know, that's the hard thing about hard things.
Also, there are, of course, independent board members that you would want to bring on that would have more specialized industry expertise that could, and that's actually one of my favorite board members that I've ever had, Rita Lane from Apple. Like, I think because she also, like, we need to think of like venture investors, they answer to their LPs, right? So they're trying to make a return and they're not industry experts in your business at all. And so I think that there needs to be a healthy mix of independent board members that can help you and be like, oh, you guys are doing this partnership with this and this, and like in my experience, you should do this. Or like, hey, like, I've actually been a CFO before and like you should be looking at doing X, Y, and Z and all these different things. And investors are just not specialized in that. And it's kind of a really weird, and they get into this in the book, is that like investors answer to their LPs, which they should, obviously, that's their job. Like they're trying to make as much money, but then also there's a lot of ego that comes into play, and there's even like product advice that comes into play. And it's just like, are you an investor? Are you an operator? Like, what are you trying to get through here? I think what you said, Julian, is like spot on. I think that a really good investor can let you know, it's like, hey, like you're falling behind. Like I don't know exactly like what like you need to do. I'm happy to maybe like hook you up with some other people that can help you in sales and marketing or product or whatever. But like the trajectory that you're on right now is you're not going to be able to raise that next round. Well,
yeah. So the magic, Andy, I'm very surprised you don't know Jeremy Noven well, but maybe not. I don't know. The magic of Jerry writing that blog post is that he is that an actual angel is an actual VC could never have written, your board is likely to fire you.
Yes.
That's actually the beautiful paradox of that situation is he used to be a VC, and I think he worked for, he was like a corporate VC at Intel or something.
He was also a
but
founder
now
first.
As an,
he was a founder that got fired by his board.
Right. And then he became a VC, and now he's an angel investor, and he's extremely successful at that. He's one of the best known angel investors in New York.
Yes.
And the magic of it is no VC could ever have told that story. They could never be like, yeah, or your board is likely to fire you. Woo! Like, gotten away with that. And like, it would have reduced their deal flow, in other words. But Jerry doesn't care. And that's, he, you know, in the past, he used to take independent board seats. I don't know if he still does. But that's kind of the magic of independent type of person who just doesn't have a
master. There are different boards. You should come in and be prepared to get some advice. You should be prepared to sit there and have to parse through it and have to make the decision. But at the end of the day, the buck stops with you. And either you perform and you do well and your business does well or you don't. It's it. And like the best board in the entire world. There are a lot, typically... The interesting thing is when you compare it to a public company board, at least in a public company board, they're typically aligned with the success of the shareholders. And I mean, they're totally compensated in the same manner. Private company, there can be divergent. There are divergent views. I mean, the board member has to be beholden to the company's shareholders, but it also has to be beholden to the company's LPs. Public company, everyone's just beholden to the common stock most of the time.
Right. Okay, let's move on to a final last question that you guys have to provide here. We have 4 minutes left. What do you guys got? I have one ready to go. If you don't.
Let's just go straight to Logan Bartlett route.
The what?
And that you were talking about Logan Bartlett's show. And
yeah.
We have been copying him all episode. And so let's just continue doing that. Whatever question 4 is, give it to us.
Yeah. So here, last question. We got 4 minutes left in the show. What do you guys think of the current market, VC market? Mm-hmm. You guys are both in it. I definitely thought that it was going to turn around in January. Andy told me I was wrong. He was right.
What year was normal and be able to
raise on not insane 2021 terms, but like when can founders expect that they can raise like a decent A or a decent B at like a fair valuation?
2016 is normal.
Right.
So when do I think it normalizes? Go ahead.
2018
was hot from my perspective. Go on.
Well, yeah, because you started your company a lot earlier. Me too. Like with Chip.
I just feel like it ebbs and flows, but it's like what I have learned throughout this process is, and we have the good fortune that we raised enough capital in 2021 that we hopefully get to ride it out completely, whatever it is. I don't even know what it is anymore. That we get to ride it out, and the result is to be able to get to a round that is meaningful at a time that's appropriate. But it's the job of the CEO to make sure that happens. And it's never been truer. It's been said many times before, hope is not a strategy. It's never been truer than today. Like, people are hoping they have time. They should not be doing that.
No.
They should be executing based on a slashed plan that says, no, you will not get money on this date the way you expected to. And maybe your customers will be harder to get as well. They should be executing with that in mind.
Yeah, I agree. And also, so are things that CEOs are having to do. Layoffs, we definitely need to do that, which is like awful, but it's needed to keep the business alive. Other things are like raising smaller rounds, extensions that we've also been successful at, even though our business is really taking off. And I'll talk about myself. Like, I feel like I have like both of my arms are being stretched so fucking like thin, because like I don't have the capital that I actually need to hire the people that like I won't burn the team out, but that's how fast we're growing. And so that's on like the good side, because if I went out right now, which our plan was to go and raise like a big Series B right now in Q3, I'm looking at the market. I'm like, I'm not fucking doing that. I'm like, we can get by. And now we're focusing more on cash flows and other things that we can like finance the business with. And so I think there's a lot of things that are at founders' disposal, but the biggest thing is like, you need to just like stay alive. That's the thing. Like, if you look back to the dot-com crash, like there was a lot of like Amazon almost went out of business and all of that. And like the big learning is like, you do like, and they took like this massive loan and it was like down to the wire and all this shit. And like, you just do whatever the fuck you need to do to survive. And like, that is your job as a CEO and founder. And then this is cyclical. We will return to normal eventually. I hope that is in the next couple quarters, but who fucking knows? And just look at the time, unless you guys have any last points, I think that's a good way to end the show, is keep your company alive and do whatever it takes, even if it's really uncomfortable. Well, Julian, thank you for joining us. And I hope that you come back as the regular host. And thank you, everybody, for listening. We missed you greatly, all your hot takes. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Obviously, thank you, as Andy, as always. And please rate and review these sessions. That helps us go up in the podcast reviews. So thanks, everybody, for listening.
See you later.